everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. We believe when the people speak, they make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with John Perkins, who has spent the last three decades as most of the last three decades as an economic hitman and is a New York Times bestselling author of a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John is a business executive, but most importantly, he is also a lecturer on shamanism. His newest book, The Secret History of the American Empire, zeroes in on hotspots around the world and drawing on interviews of other hitmen, jackals, reporters, politicians, and activists, examines the new geopolitical crisis and what we can do to change things for the next generation. John was gracious enough to be here with us while he is on tour, and he's currently speaking to us from Vancouver. Hello, John. Welcome to The People Speak.
Thank you, Basma. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it's an honor having you. You have a lot of fans here, John. I know you know that we are also have a virtual auditorium that's been monitoring your work for quite some time. Your books are being touted as popular due to the cloak and dagger aspect they have as a theme, John. Some feel that it's almost an insinuation that the books are not true, but actually based on fiction. Is this a case where truth is stranger than fiction?
Well, yes, I think that's absolutely true. The books are completely factual. I do write them in a narrative style. I recreate conversations I've had with people and try to make them fun to read so that people can understand what's going on in the world, what global economics and geopolitics is all about today, without having to get a dissertation that sounds like it's a PhD thesis or something. So I try to write them in that narrative style and make them fun and exciting to read. But everything in the books is factual.
Well, you know, actually, and I've heard this, even here in political chat rooms when we've discussed issues surrounding the book and many of the facts that have been brought out, some say that you're a madman. But if you're not a madman, then we're in some serious trouble, aren't we, John?
Well, I actually have never heard that before, that I was a madman. I may have been mad at the time I was an economic hitman, but I think I've acquired sanity in more recent years. But it's true, you know, we live in a very mad world. We live in a world where we have managed to create, since World War II, a secret empire, a huge, vast empire, the world's biggest, truly global empire, the only one. And we've done it primarily through economics, not through the military, and that's why it's secret, because when you create an empire through the military, as past emperors were created, then everybody knows that you're doing it. But when you do it through these subtle means, using economic hitmen to make it happen, then it's done in secret, and so people don't realize that it's happening. And in fact, in the United States today, we find that that the majority of the people here have no idea that we've done this, which to me is a big threat to democracy. Democracy is based on the premise that the electorate is informed, and if the electorate doesn't know one of the most important aspects of foreign policy, then you have to wonder whether we can really vote as a democracy or not.
Let me ask you, I mean, obviously we've all read and learned and talked globalization. We have it in our commercials. We teach it in our university. I think that we've already reached that paradigm shift where we actually are a global empire, but now everybody else is just trying to catch up. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment, Jen?
Well, we definitely are a global empire today. And although in the title of the book I call it an American empire, that's part because most of the big corporations have their headquarters in the United States. But in fact, it's a new type of empire. It's an empire that's really the model equivalent of the emperor is what I call the corporatocracy, which are the men and a few women who run our biggest corporations. And this isn't a conspiracy theory. These people don't have to conspire to make this happen. But, you know, in the old days, when I was growing up, we visualized the world as this big round ball with 180 some odd countries, and a few of those were very powerful, primarily in those days, the Soviet Union and the United States, and then we had the Tatar, and it was mainly the United States. But today, that geopolitics is outdated. A better way to look at the world would be this round globe of 180 some odd countries, but there are these huge clouds that drift around the entire planet. And they don't recognize national boundaries. They're not nationalistic at all. They're the big corporations. They don't recognize any particular laws of any individual land. They use whatever serves them best.
Are we in geopolitical mortal danger?
Yes, I think it may be even more serious than that. That we're in danger of creating a world that none of us, that our children won't even recognize. We must turn this around. We're seeing terrible things around this planet. The Middle East, of course, is a prime example of what's going on there. Africa is a devastated continent in so many ways and terribly, terribly exploited. Latin America has suddenly emerged and is leading the way to democracy, if you will. There's a bright light for you. But, we live in a world where less than 5% of the world's population live in the United States and consume more than 25% of our resources and create more than 30% of our pollution. The only thing you can really say about that as a model is it's a failure. It's a failed model. You can't sell that model to China with 20% of the world's population or India. You can't sell it to Africa or Latin America. We can't even keep doing it. We must change. If we're to survive on a planet that we recognize, we simply have to change.
How do we change? You hear about this all over the world. You hear about this in solution workshops. And how do we change? How do we change a paradigm that is actually taking over our economy, taking over our spirituality, now with the new Christian evangelic faiths that have become very politicized when we have media control, blackouts, things? How do you change something like that?
Well, Bassima, I think the key to the change is what I mentioned before, that the emperor is really the corporatocracy, a relatively small number of primarily men who run our biggest corporations. In order to change, we have to change their power base, and that is the corporations. So today, they operate under the assumption that the goal of all corporations should be basically greed, to maximize profits, to make a few rich people a lot richer. We need to convince them that that's not the goal, that the goal needs to be good citizens, to be good communities, to serve all of us, to create a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world. That ought to be everyone's goal. And we have to know that in order for my grandson to grow up in a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world, every child born in Pakistan and Nigeria and Palestine and Israel and Bolivia also has to have the expectation of growing up in a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world. And so we need to bring these corporations around to redefine their very reason for being, their goals, and I'm very optimistic we can do this.
What exactly is the relationship between, like, say, the private corporations, the corporatocracies that you speak of, the government and the economic hitmen that still are currently working in the field? I mean, do they have a symbiotic relationship? Do they respect and honor each other's position in what's going on? Is there mistrust? What kind of a relationship do they have?
Well, the fact of the matter is the corporatocracy really determines what the government will do. So the corporatocracy controls our media, either through direct ownership or through advertising. And they also control most of our government, because they finance the campaigns. So every elected official in this country and their staff are basically beholden to these private interests. It's shocking to think, but I just read recently that in the next presidential election in the United States, both of the final candidates, the Democrat and the Republican, each will have to raise $500 million. Now, Bassam, I ask you, is that going to come from you? Is it going to come from me? Is it going to come
not
from most
from
of your
me.
Listeners?
That I can promise you is not going to happen.
It's going to come from the big corporations, and there are limits to what corporations can contribute, but there aren't those limits do not apply to their big stockholders, the people who make their money from the corporations. And so the politicians are all very, very beholden, regardless of what their intents are or what high character they may have or whatever else they may say. In the ultimate analysis, they need that money in order to run for re-election. And so the relationship between the corporatocracy and the government essentially is a very, very cozy one. It's a very dependent one. The government is extremely dependent on these corporations to be elected. The officials are dependent to be elected. The economic hitmen, basically, we're just agents, foot soldiers of this entire system. And we're often paid by the government or through contracts. I was a private consultant with a staff of around 50 working for me, but my company was usually hired by either the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank or the Inter-American Development Bank or USAID or the Treasury Department or the State Department or one of these organizations. So while I didn't work directly for the government, my company did, and I was a partner in the company, so I personally benefited tremendously through our government contracts, or quasi-government, such as the World Bank and Inter-American Development Bank, which aren't actually our government, but they have a close relationship to it also.
You actually quit Chaz C. Maine in 1980, John. Did you stop your way of life as an economic hitman at that time, or how did you extradite yourself out of that lifestyle? I mean, I can imagine you're almost held hostage in certain situations, aren't you?
Well, that's true, and I had a moment of enlightenment when I knew that I had to get out, and I can explain that in more detail later if you want. But to answer your question, once I got out, I continued to do some consulting in the business, but I also decided to write the book, which became Confessions of an Economic Hitman, to expose the system. And I went out and talked to other economic hitmen and jackals, who were the assassins that assassinate leaders that economic hitmen can't bring around, and other people in order to get their stories to include in the book. And when the word got out, then I was approached by people who threatened me and offered me big bribes not to write the book. I took these seriously. I succumbed to the threats and the bribes, and I didn't write the book. I kept putting it off and putting it off. And so, in fact, I was at that point stuck within the system through a series of threats and bribes. And incidentally, with most of the money that I made, I put it toward nonprofit organizations like Dream Change. You can look at dreamchange.org or Pachamama, PachamaMA.org. And these are organizations that work with indigenous people and other people, people who I basically screwed as an economic hitman. And I put a lot of the money that I made through these bribes to helping those kinds of people. So it sort of assuaged my guilt, but I still didn't do what I needed to do, which was confess, to write the story, to tell people what's going on in the world.
So you feel this is almost like a confession of your own, I hate to use the word sin because I don't even believe in the word sin, but to atone for actions you may have committed in the past?
I don't know as I can ever atone for the things I did as an economic hitman. But what I do know is that, you know, I want to spend the rest of my life trying to make this a better world for my children, grandchildren, my child. I have a child and my grandchildren. I want to devote the rest of my life to making this a better world for them and their generation. And knowing that in order to do that for them, we have to do it for every child born on this planet.
You know, at least we forget, and I don't mean to focus on this at all, and I can't even imagine the feelings that you must go through when you hear this, but you were literally the precursor for targeted assassinations, John. People died if you failed to convince them of whatever it was that you needed to convince them of. How does one reconcile something like that in their life?
Well, yeah, it was a terrible position in a way, you know. As an economic hitman, I didn't do anything illegal. What I did should be illegal. One of the most important things we do is to identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil. And then we arranged a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. But the money doesn't go to the country. Instead, it goes to one of several of our big corporations to build infrastructure projects, huge infrastructure projects in that country, power plants and industrial parks, things like that that serve a few very rich people in that country, as well as our own corporations, but don't help the majority of people at all who use very little electricity, if any. They can't get jobs in industrial parks because they lack the skills. And yet the country is left holding this huge debt, so big it can't possibly repay it. So at some point, we go back to the country and say, listen, you owe us a lot of money, can't pay your, so give us a pound of flesh, sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or vote with us on the next critical UN vote, or send troops of ours, troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq. And that's not illegal. It should be, but it isn't illegal. It's, you know, if I were your private banker, Bessima, and I coerced you into accepting a loan I knew you couldn't repay to get a favor from you, that's illegal. But when I do it on an international level, it isn't. It should be, but it isn't. And
isn't
so,
that tragic?
And yeah, and I knew that if I failed to do this, to corrupt these leaders in other countries, then the jackals would step in. And for example, I really liked Jaime Roldos of Ecuador, and even I really liked Omar Torrijos of Panama, two presidents that I was sent to corrupt. And I failed in both cases. These men were not corruptible. And as a result, they both were assassinated by CIA-sponsored jackals. And I was always aware, if I failed, that the jackals were there in the background to either overthrow the governments or assassinate their leaders. And so it was an awesome responsibility, because if I failed, not only would I fail at doing my job, but I would also know that then something much more dire would happen to these men that I respected and liked. And there was really nothing at that point I could do about it, you know, except get out. And even when I got out, of course, I knew someone else would just step in to take my place.
Were you afraid?
Was I afraid?
Yeah.
Is that the,
what were you most afraid of?
Well, I was afraid to leave to begin with. And then, as I tell in the books, this Colombian woman from Colombia became a good friend of mine, pointed out to me, well, if you leave and you don't say anything, you don't spill the beans, you should be okay. And in fact, that was true, except when I let people know that I was starting to write a book, then the heavy hand came down on me and threatened me or bribed me. And yes, I was afraid, so I didn't continue. I deferred until after 9/11, when I finally, many years later, finally decided I had to write the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
There's a couple of things I'd like to ask you, John. Who are you going to vote for? Which is kind of, I think, a scary question, asking someone who knows probably so much about the back end of corruption in our government. Who does one vote for under the circumstances?
Well, at this point, I couldn't say, but I think, you know, what we all have to do, whether we're talking about the president or whether we're talking about local officials, is insist that they address the real issues, that they address things like climate change and the corrupting that our country does, and exploitation, and the fact that so few of us, less than 5% of the world's population, are consuming more than 25% of its resources, and the tragedy of what's going on in Palestine and Israel, all over the Middle East, and Africa, and so much of the world, the slavery that's out there, that's a reason why we live such great lives here in this country. We need to insist that our candidates address that. And so far, I haven't heard any of them really addressing those issues at this point. But I believe that they will by the time the election comes around. And, you know, I speak out on it all the time, and I would encourage all of your listeners to, you know, write to their politicians, speak out, go to hear them speak and ask them questions. What are you really saying about the real deep issues? Let's not just deal with the minor, with the cuts that are on the skin, and put Band-Aids on them. Let's really go beneath the surface and see what's causing us to hemorrhage.
Let me ask you, Jen, you know, in light of the horrible nightmare that has been created in Iraq, and we know for a fact that this has literally destabilized the entire Middle East region, whether anybody wants to admit it or not doesn't make any difference. Halliburton, Bechtel, Boeing, Enron, GE, Schlumberger, United Technologies, Raytheon, they're making a fortune over there.
And they absolutely are.
Is this a failed war if so many people are making so much money there?
If you have a child or a relative who's died in that war, or if you have friends who are in the military today, you may look at it as a failed war, or a war that's in the process of failing. Most Americans, I think, would look at it that way. Most of us would look at Vietnam as a failed war. But if you happen to be a member of the corporatocracy, somebody who runs our big corporations, you don't look at either of those wars as a failure. Vietnam was a huge success. People made fortunes off Vietnam. and we're doing, and they're doing the same thing today in Iraq. So it all depends on your perspective. I think they're failed wars, but the members of the corporatocracy don't see them that way.
Let me ask you, John. You are now, you have been a shamanic lecturer and healer and teacher and spokesperson for quite some time. You deal with a lot of the indigenous people in the world. And as a matter of fact, you're currently on tour lecturing about this. How did this happen? That there was this, was there a particular defining, I know that you spoke in the books and interviews about the point when your daughter and you faced each other and she helped you to write the books, to write the story, definitely to write the story, but within your own spirit, and we all know that that's how it really works. There had to be something that was ignited within you. Was there ever a defining moment that you can recall at this point?
There were a couple, Bess. And, first of all, I was an economic hitman for just 10 years, and during that period I always struggled with my conscience. People were telling me I was doing a good thing. I was being patted on the back by Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank. I was asked to lecture at Harvard and other prestigious universities. So it was kind of easy to convince myself I was doing good stuff, but in my heart I knew otherwise. And I'd been in the Peace Corps before that, living with indigenous people in the Amazon and the Andes, trained as a shaman way back in the late 60s before I did this. So in my heart, I knew it was wrong, but it was easy to convince myself otherwise. And then after 10 years, I was sailing in the Caribbean on vacation, and I anchored my sailboat off St. John Island in the Virgin Islands, and I climbed it to the top of this hill where there was an old ruins of an old sugarcane plantation up there, and the sun was setting over the Caribbean, the bougainvillea was covering this plantation. It was quite lovely. But as I sat there, I realized that that plantation had been built on the bones of thousands of slaves. And then it struck me that the whole hemisphere has been built on the bones of millions of slaves. And then I came to an understanding that I, too, was a slaver. What I was doing around the world was creating forms of slavery to exploitation. And in fact, our culture, all of us who live materialistically comfortable lives in the United States, really are living off the fruits of exploitation, of forms of slavery, of imperialism. And at that moment, I decided I could never do this anymore. And so a couple of days later, I went back to my headquarters in Boston and resigned. But as I mentioned earlier, I didn't write the book. I was threatened and bribed and didn't write it for many years. And on 9/11, I was actually in the Amazon with the people I had been a Peace Corps volunteer with many, many years before. But shortly after 9/11, I flew to Ground Zero. And as I stood there looking down into that smoldering pit, I knew I had to write the book. I knew the American people had to understand what was going on in the world, why there's so much anger and resentment and hatred, which is in no way to condone the mass murder that occurred there on 9/11. But it is to say, I knew I had to talk about it. I had to get the message out. And so this time I also decided I would tell no one I was writing the book. I wouldn't contact any other economic hitmen or jackals. And until the book was in the hands of my agent and was being sent out to publishers, and at that point it became my best insurance policies, so that any jackal at that time would realize that if something dire and strange happened to me, then the book would sell many, many millions more copies than it would otherwise.
Are there people speaking out? You speak of people that are coming out after you wrote the original book, and in The Secret of the American Empire, which is John Perkins' newest novel, or book, not a novel. Yeah, and can I ask you, these people, are you at liberty to mention some names of people that we need to look for that are honorably trying to get out of this kind of lifestyle?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of them in the book, The Secret History of the American Empire, that are mentioned in there. And some of them, their real names are in there, some of them have to remain anonymous because they're still in the business or very dependent on the business for their pensions, et cetera, and don't want their names used. But there's both kinds. There's people from the United States. There's people from other countries, like a very high government official in Brazil and others. And there's another book called The Game as Old as Empire, which I wrote the introduction to, where there are chapters written by these people and also by researchers who've gone into this a lot. So, you know, once I wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, other economic hitmen and jackals contacted me and other people and wanted to tell their stories, and those stories are in The Secret History of the American Empire.
Why are you alive, John? I mean, why? Do you think it was just the book? Do you think that, or do they, you know, there's this issue of conspiracy theories, and a lot of people sit there and listen to the stuff, and they always talk about studying the waters and stuff like that. Do you think that perhaps they maybe were just hoping that you would just be seen as one of those conspiracy theorists or something?
Well, yeah, but listen, Bassam, it's more than that. You know, Confessions now is, I think, in its 64th week on the New York Times bestseller list. Nonetheless,
yes,
it's sold. But nonetheless, it's sold. I don't even know anymore. Something between 500,000 and a million copies. Something approaching a million copies. But that's not much in a country of over 300 million people. And you know, the government and the jackals don't look at that as a huge threat. And they're pretty arrogant anyway. They don't really think that a writer can threaten them. Now, if I were running for Senate or president or something like that, this would be a different matter. But after all, I'm just a writer, and they don't look at writers as a threat. I happen to think they're wrong. I think that in the last couple of years, we've seen a huge change in attitudes in this country, and a lot of that is because of a lot of books, not just mine, but a number of other writers, movies like Syriana and The Constant Gardener and Blood Diamond and Al Gore's movie and so many other things coming out like that now, that I think collectively the world of media, programs like yours and other alternative media programs are having a huge impact. But you come right down to it, and the government knows that. You know, so a million people read my book, big deal. If they killed me, if I were to die a strange death tonight, then suddenly a lot more people would read the book, and probably ones that wouldn't have bought it otherwise. You know, the government thinks that most of the million people reading my book are people who already agree with me anyway, probably. But if something strange happens to me, it suddenly becomes a huge curiosity factor, and a lot of other people start buying the book, and that's the last thing they want to have happen.
So they just kind of are hoping you'll disappear into the limelight somehow and be satisfied with just the book. And
exactly.
We have to take a break right now, John, and we'll be back shortly. For those of you who have just tuned in, we're speaking with New York Times bestseller and author of The Secret History of the American Empire and Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins. You can call us at 888-861-3519. That is our international toll-free number. And ask John a question. Please give us a call. We'll be back in just a moment.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. That when walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, and all around me voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, yeah, that that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. We're back from our break. This is Basma Farhad of People Speak Radio Show, and tonight we're interviewing John Perkins, New York Times bestseller of The Economic Hitman and the New York Times newest book, The Secret History of the American Empire. Welcome back, John.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
We had a lot of background noise. I guess our broadcasting station has a puppy dog in the background. We're listening to it the whole time. John has his hands full, I guess.
Sounds that way.
Yeah, he sure does. We have a question from someone in the audience right now, John. I'm going to give it to Derry. Derry, would you take the mic, please, and tell us where you're calling from and your question for John. Gary, are you with us? Okay, I guess not. We're going to go to our... Oh, okay, go ahead, Gary.
Thank you. Hello, John. This is Dari speaking from Connecticut. Thank you for being here. We're very honored to have you. I'm relaying a question for someone in our audience tonight who doesn't have a microphone. Some of this was probably touched upon, but the end part of the question I don't think has been. This is from Keith in Oklahoma, and he would like to know, how does this corporate power that we've been referring to relate to the military-industrial complex and the war in Iraq and the selection of corporate-friendly leaders like Bush? I think the last part of that question, the corporate-friendly leader part, is something we haven't touched upon. So back to you, Basma and John. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Well, first of all, the military-industrial complex was a term coined by President Eisenhower in his last address as President of the United States, and it's basically, I think, been redefined as the corporatocracy. That's kind of my term for it, which I think, in a way, is a better term today, because, after all, we interpret industry differently today than we did in Eisenhower's day. So corporatocracy is all the big corporations. Some of them aren't heavy industries anymore. They're involved in computer and very soft industries. And, you know, the politicians are very friendly to the corporatocracy. There's no question about it. And that's because they are supported by the corporatocracy. Nobody gets to hold a public office in this country, essentially, or very few people do, unless they're receiving a lot of money for their campaigns. All of these people depend on a great deal of money. So they're very beholden to the corporatocracy, and therefore are constantly listening to them and trying to return favors to the big corporate heads.
Thank you, John. For those of you that would like to call in, 888-861-3519 is our international toll-free number. Our next call is from Kate from Australia. Kate, can you give us your question, please, for John Perkins?
Well, I don't know if you can actually hear me. I haven't called in. Can you hear me? Do I have a mic?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello? Yes? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Perkins. I'm really enjoying the show this morning. Thank you, Bassima. Mr. Perkins, we continue in these rooms and in our lives to get into endless debates about why America invaded Iraq. We have a person in this room who really does need to hear from a person such as yourself, I believe, who has a finger on the pulse of many things that are happening around the world. Could you give us a statement, so I can put in quotes here that I got it from John Perkins, why did America attack Iraq? Why?
Well, I'd be happy to. It's much more detailed in The Secret History of the American Empire. When that reaches Australia, you'll find more details in there. But the long version is, and in order to even do the short version, you have to first look at Saudi Arabia. In the early 70s, the OPEC basically closed down oil, embargoed oil to the United States, and we had long lines at the gas station. It was a very serious crisis here. The Treasury Department came to me and other economic hitmen and said, listen, we can't allow this to happen again. Can't be blackmailed by OPEC. Come up with a plan. Well, we knew any such plan had to involve Saudi Arabia. And so because Saudi Arabia had more oil than anyone else, and the House of Saud, the royal family, was corrupt and corruptible. And so I went to Saudi Arabia, and several other economic hitmen and I worked on this, and we finally came up with a deal that was signed by the House of Saud, whereby they returned most of the dollars they made selling oil around the world to the United States, investing it in U.S. government securities. The interest from that security, from those securities, was used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, build big petrochemical complexes, industrial parks, in fact, whole cities from the desert. American corporations became very rich in the process. Also, the Saudis agreed never to buy oil for anything but dollars, which put the dollar in a very favored position around the world. It became the world's standard currency. And we agreed to protect the House of Saud, to keep them in power. It was a very, very successful deal, history-changing. Perhaps one of the most significant deals, certainly since World War II, the most significant deal that I'm aware of in the last century. And then after that, we decided that we needed to get Saddam Hussein to accept something very similar in Iraq, the second largest oil producer. So we went to work on Saddam, but he didn't buy the deal. He would have nothing to do with it. So we sent the jackals in to take him out. They couldn't take him out because his security was too good. He had too many look-alike doubles. And so we sent the military in 91. Now, our military took out his military, could have taken him out, but didn't want to, because he's the kind of strong man we like, someone who keeps the oil flowing, keeps the radicals at bay, keeps the Iranians behind their borders. And so we thought he'd been sufficiently chastised by destroying his military that in the 90s he would come around, but he didn't. And so we went back in. And, of course, in the process, we also... since he wouldn't make the agreement to use oil money to hire our corporations to build up the country, we're now going ahead and destroying the country and rebuilding it with our big construction companies. So it's become a boondoggle. And again, that's a very brief summary of something that's detailed much more specifically in A Secret History of the American Empire.
And ergo, we are having our soldiers, both men and women, die in a foreign country for economic reasons that had nothing to do with why Paul Wolfowitz, Bolton, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the others wanted this war.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, it had nothing to do with democracy, of course. We support dictators all over the world, and we try to overthrow democratically elected presidents when they don't do what we want them to do for our corporations. If Saddam had bought our deal, like the House of Saud did, and their dictatorship, basically, then he would still be president. He'd still be running the country.
Not only that, but he probably would have had a flourishing society, if I'm not mistaken, right, John?
I'm sure he would have, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and this really gives us the key, Bessima, for how we have to turn this around. You know, I talked about how, you know, we have to change corporate goals to be better citizens, to work toward a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world. And we've had tremendous success at changing corporations whenever we put our hearts and minds to it. So we've gotten them to clean up in the United States terribly polluted rivers and get rid of producing aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer and install seatbelts and airbags and cars and open their doors to minorities. And recently we got big food vendors to get rid of trans fats and in the chicken industry. Tyson's just a couple of weeks ago announced that it was no longer going to put antibiotics in its chickens because we, the consumer, were demanding it. When we make these demands on corporations, we have a tremendous amount of power. We really can turn them around. They depend on us to buy everything they produce. They depend on us for their labor. We can turn them around. Now we need to ratchet this up a notch, and instead of going after the specific issues as we've done in the past and proven we can be successful, we now need to go after them and say, listen, you must change your whole reason for being. You are in existence as a community because we need to create a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world, and that's your job as a corporation. No longer is it your job just to look at the bottom line, windfall profits for a few rich people.
Well, this is what we believe here on the People Speak Radio, and that's basically why we started this program, John. When the people speak, they make a difference. I think here in this country and around the world, we've forgotten that. Either we've forgotten it or we have been socially engineered by inane, ridiculous media, underdeveloped book fodder in order to convince us that we don't have any power. And that's not true. Our next guest, question is coming from Steve from Santa Fe. Steve, will you please give us your question for John?
Well, thank you, Bessemer. Thank you. And thank you, John, for taking your time to come talk to us. It's very interesting. You touched on my question just a moment ago. My question would be, what action on our part as civilians, as citizens, would you think would be most productive in changing this corporate atmosphere? Thank you.
Great question, Steve. Thank you for asking it. I have a long list in the Secret History of the American Empire of things we all can do and should do. You know, things that most of us already know about. Don't buy from companies you know are using sweatshops to make your T-shirts and tennis shoes. And let them know why you're not buying from them. And let the ones that you do buy from that aren't doing it this way, let them know why you're buying from them. You know, we need to all reduce our energy consumption, be more efficient. You know, these are fairly common things, but there's a long list of them in the books, and we all should do them. But, you know, in a way, those are Band-Aids. And we need the Band-Aids because we're hemorrhaging badly. But we also need to go deeper and change these corporations, make them become better citizens. Let that be their defining goal, is to create a better world for future generations. And every one of us must take our own route. You know, I can't answer the question for every person, but we all have passion. And you have passion. And you have talents. I'm a writer. That's my passion, and I hope I have some talents at it. But whatever you do, wherever you are in life, you could be retired, you could be a teacher, you could be a massage therapist, a carpenter, whatever you are, you have passions and you have talents. Bring those to bear. And as long as we can all take different paths, as long as we're all headed toward this destination of making a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world for every child everywhere. You know, I often think back to the American Revolution and how fortunate we are that Tom Paine didn't try to lead armies, George Washington didn't try to write pamphlets, and Benjamin Franklin didn't do either. He was in his 70s and became a diplomat and convinced the French to become our allies. Every one of these people took a different path that satisfied their passions and their talents, but they were all headed toward the same goal. And, you know, we must follow that sort of example. So each one of us takes our own path, and we all head toward the same goal, and we will achieve that goal.
Well, thank you very much, John. Our next question is from Sue. Sue, from Massachusetts, if you'll come to and give your question to John, please.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Basima. No, it's fine. It's fine. I think I'm okay. June, you're talking about corporations. Would you consider the United States of America right now as USA Incorporated or as a viable country? I don't want to go on with this, but I would like to know what is your consideration as the United States right now. Is it, in your mind, is it in fact a corporation? Go ahead, John. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. I wouldn't define our government as being a corporation. And I think, you know, when we talk about the USA, what do we really mean? Do we mean the government? Do we mean we the people? What do we really mean by that? And I like to think of the United States as a very potent place, a place I deeply love. I feel very, very patriotic. It's not a corporation. It's not the government. It's we the people. And it's represented by our most sacred documents, like our Declaration of Independence that says, we the people, it's government by the people, for the people, and of the people, and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people everywhere, not just in the original 13 colonies or today between the Rio Grande and the Canadian border, but everybody everywhere. That should be our ideal. And yet, our government is very closely tied into all the big corporations, what I call the corporatocracy. So the corporations today really are running the system around the world, and they're using the United States as their springboard. This is their power base. This is where most of them are located, and this is the government that has the military that can back up these corporations. So in essence, we really are run by the corporations, although I don't consider the people of the United States to really be part of that corporation, and yet the corporations are very dependent on us. So we must turn it around. They have to listen to us. They've shown this time and time again. Whenever we've stood up to them and said, we demand that you open your doors wider to women or other minority groups, they do it. We demand that you start cleaning up the rivers and the garbage in this country, they do it. And now we must demand that they become good communities, that they set as their main goal creating a better world for our children and grandchildren.
I think part of the thing is, too, that we have, not only do we have to demand, but how do we demand? There are many ways that we can peacefully dissent, many ways that we can demand. We can boycott, we can start letter-writing campaigns, our vote speaks in and of itself. There are just a ton of ways that we can speak out. I mean, I think that part of the problem is, and I think once we eventually get back, regain our power, empower each other, empower ourselves, I think that's going to say a lot, John, in the future.
I totally agree. No, I totally agree, Simone. And, I talk a lot in the book about organizations like Rainforest Action Network and MoveOn.com and Amnesty International and the Civil Rights Movement and the Women's Rights Movement. These have been very, very effective movements. And I really encourage people to join some movement like this, like-minded people who want to create change. And, if you're for the environment, join an environmental movement. If you're for human rights, join a human rights movement. If you're for animal rights, join an animal rights movement. But get involved. Either give some of your time, or if you have money and not time, give money. If you have time and not money, give time. But get involved, because these organizations are extremely potent. They've created amazing change. I talk a lot in the book about these. I talk a lot about how Rainforest Action Network had a major impact on Mitsubishi and Citicorp and Boise Cascade and Home Depot and McDonald's and so many other corporations. It's had a major impact with a staff of only about 20 people at the time and a very small budget. So we can have tremendous impact, and you're right. Different people have to take different routes, Basima. Some people will be happy to get out in the street and march and demonstrate. Others will write letters or emails. Others will just do it by how they buy goods and how they talk. Every one of us, every day, influences a lot of people around us, even if we don't realize it. We have a tremendous impact by the way we buy, by the way we talk, by the things we read, et cetera.
Absolutely. Another a question via Dari here. Dari, please let us know who the question is from.
Okay, thank you again, Basima. John, this is Dari from The People Speak in Connecticut again with another question from an audience member without a microphone. It's from Jeanette in Michigan. She would like to know if you have or ever will consider running for political office, preferably president, and she intends to write you in regardless. So back to you.
Well, thank you.
There you go, John.
The answer is I never have run for public office, and I do not intend to. I appreciate that. And on C-SPAN, filmed me talking in a New York bookstore a few weeks ago, and somebody stood up and made a very impassioned speech about that too. But that's not my job, you know. It's not that good people need to run for president, but I'm a writer and a speaker. And that's what I want to continue doing. I want to write more about these things. I want to talk to more people like I'm doing now and put it in books and speak. And I'm not a politician. I understand the corporate world much better than I do the political world. And I want to change this through the corporate world. I am speaking a lot to corporations and conferences of corporate executives, trying to convince them to come around too. And that's not as hard as it seems. Every corporate executive I've ever known is a human being. Like you and me, and most of them have children and grandchildren. I've never met one that wanted to see Florida flooded, wanted to see climate change. I've never met one who likes terrorism. I've never met one who wants to see the ozone layer destroyed. I've never met one who wants to see forests around the world destroyed. But they're stuck in this paradigm that says we have to keep creating more and more profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. We need to tell them to change. We need to give them permission. Once we put pressure on them, most of them are grateful when people do demonstrate, when people make the boards of directors and the stockholders realize that there's a serious problem here and that the corporation has to become a better citizen. That's my job.
That's all of our jobs, I think, John, and I honor you, but I have a feeling that and I know Jeanette, I have a feeling she's still going to write your name in just because she wants to.
Yeah, well, that's fine. She has that right.
Our next question is from Cheryl from the UK. Cheryl, will you please give us your question for John?
Thank you, Vixie. I hope you can hear me. I've noted your reason for the invasion of Iraq, and given that reason and the absolute death and destruction of millions of Iraqis, innocent Iraqis, and the displacement of even millions more, my question to you, having spent many years in the Middle East myself, is there anything that we can do to stop the death and destruction of innocent people in the name of greed, power, and corruption? And what do you think is going to happen inside Iraq over the next 2 or 3 years? And that's my question to you.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
Stop this. And I think, you know, you're speaking from the UK. What you can do is different from what we in the United States can do, but all of us must put an end to this, and the UK has been very much an ally of the United States in this, and so some of what you can do is similar to what we can do, but in other countries it may be different, but we all must speak out loudly against this. It's a terrible, terrible thing that's going on. We all know that. We must speak out against it, and in an election year in the United States, and you too in the UK are entering that sort of time, we must insist that our politicians address this issue, and we must let them know that we want no more of this, that we want all efforts to be aimed at peace, bringing peace to the Palestinians, bringing peace to the Israelis, bringing peace to the Iraqis, that we all must aim for peace and cut out the greed, cut out the ridiculous language that says that we're there to make the Middle East a better place. It's obvious to everybody Iraq is not benefiting from this war. Nobody is benefiting from it. cut that out, and let's insist that all of our politicians during these election years cut that out. Let's not buy things from corporations that are deeply involved there, like the ones that Nessima listed before, General Electric and Halliburton and Bechtel and so many others like that. Let's write letters to them and tell them, we're not going to buy from you anymore unless you get out. Don't buy from the oil companies that are benefiting from that oil. And we need to all become very conscious to wake up and to take actions. And you from the UK, you spoke very passionately. Follow your passions and use your talents in a way that will bring this to an end. But we mustn't be lethargic. They count on us being lethargic. We must speak out and we must take action.
Thank you, John. We have, I think, one more question here from Carrie from Philadelphia. This is the last question, folks, for John. Carrie, are you with us?
Well, thank you, Basma, and thank you, John, so much. I enjoyed your book tremendously. But, sir, I'll just try to be quick and to the point. Having all the years of experience of doing the type of work you did with the type of people that you did, can't you or have you ever thought of these type of people just doing this internationally? What is to stop them from doing this domestically, i.e., false flag terror like 9/11? So it was 9/11 an inside job, in your opinion? In my opinion, it was. Thank you.
Well, first of all, what's to stop people from using economic hitman techniques in the United States? Nothing, and in fact, it's happening more and more. You know, huge amounts of college debt, credit card debt. You know, when I was an economic hitman in my early 20s, I was making a lot of money, but it took me 6 months to get a credit card. And when my daughter turned 18 and was still in high school, had no job, she was inundated with credit cards. That's part of this. Getting rid of pension funds and Social Security and Medicare, those are all sort of economic hitman techniques coming home to roost here. We mustn't allow that to happen. We must realize that when we forego our principles in other countries and allow economic hitmen to work in Africa or Asia or Latin America or the Middle East, because we sort of turn a blind eye and we benefit from the cheap clothes and the cheap oil and the cheap coltan and so many other things, that eventually comes back to haunt us here at home, and it's happened. And so we must put our foot down to these things and say, no, you know, our corporations today are paying less than 8% of the national income tax base comes from corporations. During World War II, over 50% came from them. In 2001, over 20% came from them. They're just getting away with murder, literally, in this country. We must stop that. We must insist that they pay their fair share. As to 9/11, you know, I don't like to talk about things I don't have any personal experience with. I don't like to speculate, and you probably know as much about 9/11 as I do. I don't want to speculate about it, but I will say that I'm amazed that the Pentagon has got a hole in it. Nobody knows exactly how it seems, but perhaps more important than that, no big heads rolled. I don't know of any generals that lost their jobs because our nation's number one fortress wasn't properly defended. That's very suspicious. I think these things need to be investigated a lot more and a lot more seriously, but I have no inside information about what happened at 9/11.
Well, thank you very much, and that's a very interesting perspective, one I had never thought of, John. This is John Perkins, ladies and gentlemen, author of his latest book, The Secret History of the American Empire, New York Times bestselling author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and that one is still going strong on the New York bestseller list. John, thank you very much for being with us. Our next week's guest, folks, is Jordan Day, director of the D.C. headquarters of the United Nations World Food Program. The World Food Program is the largest humanitarian organization, and he'll be with us speaking next Tuesday, July 24th, between 8 and 9 Eastern here on The People Speak. Thank you very much, everyone. It's been wonderful having you. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bessemer.
Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Keep up your great work of spreading the word.
And you keep up your great work because we need more honorable men in our world today.
Thank you.
This land is yours. This land is mine. From Kansas. skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing.